Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Spencer J. Quinn on the show. Spencer, how are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Now, you have written this book, Solzhenitsyn and the Right. Well, first, yes. you write novels?
Yes, I do that as well.
Okay, so you're an author, and you also contribute to Countercurrents.
Yes.
Okay, so they can follow your columns there. I guess you touched on the issues that Countercurrents is infamous for.
I presume so. Yes.
So you are a proud member of the so-called dissident right. Is that a fair description?
Yes.
Okay, and you're an advocate for white interest or a white nationalist.
Both.
Both. Okay, so there's no contradiction in your mind. So, okay. So that's what you do. You write about things. Now you've written this book, Solzhenitsyn and the Right, which is sort of from what I gathered, it's written because in the intro of the book, you talk about how Solzhenitsyn was such an important figure, particularly in the 20th century, but he transcends, the 20th century, especially considering what's going on in the West, particularly in the United States these days. And you lament the fact that he's very important in his writings, but his books were so long that it intimidates most people from reading the material. And you wrote this book to sort of ease people into it, to introduce people to Solzhenitsyn's thoughts, because you see his thoughts and his writings, his work, is being more relevant than ever, even though the Cold War is over, the Soviet Union is in the dustbin of history. But there was much more going on than just the Cold War. That dialectic was sort of a stage, not stage, but managed situation. And there was much more going on, particularly in the West, because where Marxist-Leninism seems to have died, cultural Marxism appears ascendant today. And so you wrote this book. Is that a fair a description of your motivations for the book?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Quite good.
Okay, so Solzhenitsyn and the Right. What's Solzhenitsyn's relevance to today's dissident right?
Okay, well, he was an ethno-nationalist. You know, he identified as Russian, and he was a very serious Christian, but he wasn't the kind of Christian that would override his ethnocentrism. I think those were competing or equal impulses in his mind. And so, you know, he would, because he was a serious Christian and an ethno-nationalist, he sort of had a ready-made antidote for the left. You know, he was not, and especially his, you know, his prison sentence, you know, probably sealed the deal for him. But, you know, he did not buy into the left. He understood that, you know, liberalism, as we see it, is basically maybe a different branch, but shares the same root with Bolshevism, and he knows that that's just not going to go anywhere. He knows the evil behind Bolshevism. He witnessed it firsthand, and also he lamented how the Bolsheviks get kind of ignored in the West or celebrated. One or the other. And he had a big problem with that because, you know, he would say, okay, it's fine that you would denounce or condemn Nazis, but, you know, the Bolsheviks were just as bad. And he laid out just impeccable argument after argument after argument on how this is the case. In fact, my reading of Solzhenitsyn indicates that that the Bolsheviks were worse, you know, than the Nazis at their worst, because the Bolsheviks were committing their atrocities during peacetime. And the Nazis were not doing that. Nobody was invading the Soviet Union in 1933 when they, were doing their terror famines, the Holodomor, and things like that. So, you know, he is very much anti-left and anti-Marxism, however you want to call it. As you said, it could be real. It could be like original Marxism, or it could be cultural Marxism. He was against all of that. And so, you know, we can take a lot of inspiration from him, because he was also a dissident, just like many on the right are today. Although I have to say that, you know, his dissidence was a lot more dangerous than it is today. So, for example, the KGB tried to kill him a couple times. And he was on like the wanted list of many international leftist organizations that, you know, after he moved to the West, they tried to get him at least right away. Maybe not later on when he moved to the States, but when he lived in Switzerland for a while, he relates how one leftist terrorist organization got to his house a week or two after he moved to the West, but they were going to kill him. And the KG in Invisible Allies, which is one of his memoirs, he describes how he includes a letter that a KG or former KGB agent wrote to Pravda, maybe? I mean, a Russian newspaper admitting to the fact that the Soviets nearly assassinated him by stabbing him in the leg with like a needle, you know, to make him really, really sick and to kill him. And he was sick for weeks and then he survived. So, yeah, I mean, we can take heart in a lot of his dissident activities as well, because, you know, he had to deal with oppression on a scale that is, at least at this point, you know, an order of magnitude greater than what people in dissident right, at least in America, have to face. Although what's going on with Sam Melia
in England.
Is, you know, we're creeping towards that, especially in Europe, which is a very frightening thing.
Or the January 6th protesters, you know, where.
Yeah, them too. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Good point.
And of course, you talk about him being attacked by a mob. That brings to mind Antifa and Black Lives Matter mobs, you know, harassing.
Right. People. Well, not a mob. I don't think he was. I don't know if he was ever mobbed. It was more like a shadowy terrorist organization would have him on their list and they would try to find him.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And what we know from the Cold War is that both East and West played that game.
did the Americans assassinate people? Probably. Yeah,
well, that's why they had the heart attack gun that was revealed in church committee hearings, right? The CIA and
with all this MK Ultra stuff. There was a lot of that. Yeah. There was also the LSD experiments.
MK Ultra.
A lot of very unethical things.
Well, there are people who think that, of course, Thomas Merton, the Christian theologian, was murdered, thrown down the stairs. There's techniques for it's in the handbook, and of course there's the occasional bombings and car accidents and
actually one day I want to write an essay about how about the conspiracy theory on how General George Patton
that's interesting, and also same with, what's his name, the first secretary of defense, you know, Forrestal, you know.
Could have been, yeah. I mean, I haven't read the book yet. I have the book. I haven't read it yet, though.
Yeah. Apparently, these people that were opposed to the emerging Cold War, you know, military industrial state, was, you know, he was very skeptical about Israel and Zionism and its influence the government. And right after meeting, he had his own skepticism about his part in the war after what he
and the Soviet Union too. He hated the Soviets.
Yeah, but it was Forrestal who was pushing back. And I think the afternoon of the morning he met with Lyndon Johnson, who was then a senator. He jumped out the window, you know. So, but be that as it may,
I didn't know that. I'll check that out.
Be that as it may, but I don't know
if the people on the West tried to murder an author. I mean, there might have been, you know, like I'm sure there were attempts on Castro's life, you know, with
the exploding conch shell and all things. There's Operation Mongoose, of course, which some people believe was turned around and targeted a sitting president as opposed to a recalcitrant, you know, communist dictator in Latin America. There's, you know, the mechanics and all that's all set up, the, you know, assassinations and all that. So right. once you set up that infrastructure, how do you control, especially within a deep state? But generally speaking, the West has a much more, I think, sophisticated means of control, totalitarian control, than the Soviet system of barking dogs and concrete and barbed wire seemed less resilient.
Gulags
were more acute and more, the optics were awful, and obviously the experiences were awful. It seemed to be less effective, meaning that basically the West has followed the Brave New World model as opposed to the Orwell 1984 model, you know, of control.
That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, though, is that millions of people were political prisoners in the Gulag system.
Yes.
And I don't think there's anything in the West that is during
nothing
the Cold
like
War that could equal that. I mean,
no. I mean, obviously, you're dealing with two different systems. And that's one thing that Solzhenitsyn, I think, was contending with when he came to the West. But first, Solzhenitsyn, born 1918, dies 2008, a long life, almost 90 years on the planet. He unfortunately came of age, in the 1930s. And so he was drawn, he was committed Bolshevik or communist, like it, most people indoctrinated. And he has this experience in the war, I think late in the war, late 44, where he talks about, he witnesses the brutal treatment of particularly the Germans and the with the advancing Red Army. And he says some bad things about Stalin, and he ends up in a camp and he suffers in the gulag. He was a physicist or scientist, so he got sort of the relative comfort of a special camp. Then he got sent to a brutal gulag, I think like 1950. And he's released. He's released because Stalin dies, and there's a de-Stalinization program under Khrushchev that begins. And so he's sort of celebrated for a little while by Khrushchev because they want to emphasize the crimes of Stalin, pin it all on Stalin as opposed to the regime itself. But then all of a sudden, I think it's One Day in Life, Ivan Denisovich was actually read in the Soviet Union. But then he publishes the Gulag Archipelago, I think it was 1960 or early 60s. He publishes it in the West, that then he becomes sort of persona non grata in the Soviet Union. He refuses to leave to accept the Nobel Prize for Literature, fearing that he wouldn't be able to return. So he's willing to suffer oppression in the Soviet Union, persecution because his love of Russia. But finally, he leaves. I think 1974, he comes to the West, gets receives his award, lives in Switzerland, and moves to the United States. And he gives this Harvard address where he expresses, I think it was a world torn apart or split apart, I think was the title of 1978 commencement at Harvard. And he shocked many people because he came out and was very critical of the West. But the things I kind of alluded to was the Western way of seducing people with breads and circuses, and the West had gone weak and lost the idea of God, of the transcendent, overly legalistic. But I'll let you take it from there, because you have a chapter on the Harvard address, which is when Solzhenitsyn was kind of forgotten or kind of just shunted aside by the establishment in the West, because he wasn't a cheerleader for the West.
Right. Well, first of all, he witnessed a lot of the atrocities that the Soviets committed against the Germans during the latter end of World War II, and he wrote a poem about it called Prussian Nights. I have the translation by Robert Conquest, who wrote really great books on the Great Terror and the Holodomor. The Holodomor book is called A Harvest of Sorrow, and the Great Terror is called The Great Terror. And so Conquest is a big deal. And, for Solzhenitsyn, for him to translate Solzhenitsyn was interesting. And what comes through, I didn't write about it because I might have mentioned it, but I didn't actually dedicate a chapter to it because I'm reading it in translation. So I'm sure there's a lot that I'm missing because my Russian is minimal. I can read some, but it's not like on the level of a scholar. So, but the disgust that Solzhenitsyn felt during, witnessing these atrocities is very palpable in this poem. So I do recommend that. And it's brief too. For a poem it's long, but for a book it's brief. And then you did forget that he suffered from cancer.
That's right.
And that is, I think, another reason why they let him go, because he had to send him to a spa area, where there was a hospital where he could recover. And this was in the early 1950s. And probably after Stalin died. And he was he wrote his novel Cancer Ward based on his experiences there, which was really fascinating. He was cobbling together information about Gulag Archipelago all throughout the 60s. I don't think he had the manuscripts completed until the late 60s. I mean, that's 1,800 pages total, I believe, at least in my editions. And he was he would always have to find hidey holes for them, and he had all his invisible allies that would type them up and make copies and not let anybody see them, and he had to keep track of where he was burying his work You know, it was very cloak and dagger and tremendous amount of dedication, because he could have just at any point said, you know what, I don't need to do this. I mean, people were really liked One Day in the Life, and I could just go ahead and be a Soviet author and live the good life and not worry about it, because he was feted for a while, you know. But he said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going to stick to my guns and do the right thing, which is expose the atrocious nature of the Gulag system. And his dedication, despite all odds and the risk taking, made the world such a better place, because he was able to expose one of the few people that was able to do this. There were others, but he was the most famous one for sure. Anyway, so what more do we need to discuss from this period of his career? You covered a lot of ground, and I want to make sure I got everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's interesting that he, of course, the Soviet dissident, he was pointing out the cynicism, corruption of the Soviet system as a Russian. And one thing I find interesting about his life was, of course, his suffering, his passion, if you will. And this was where his Christianity played a big part in, because as opposed to becoming a cynic and becoming alienated from God, it was his suffering that brought him closer to God. And that is something that's forgotten in the West. That's something that is central to Christianity.
Right.
His sort of, despite being indoctrinated into the dispensation that was imposed on Russia in 1918 through 1922, when the Bolsheviks won the Civil War with a large amount of aid from the West. That's something most people don't realize.
That's
communism
another thing.
Was imposed upon Russia. It wasn't native to Russia. It's one thing that Solzhenitsyn was very keen to point out, that this was an imposition on Russia. It wasn't a Russian creation.
Right, because Russians made up a minority of Bolsheviks. Mm-hmm. The majority were either Jews or Latvians. He said there were some Chinese and other Asian folks. As far as Russians go, like true Russians, there were very few. And of course, Stalin and Beria were Georgian as well. Mm-hmm. He was. But one thing you mentioned was the Harvard Address. And yeah, the thing is, though, is that, you know, when you actually read it, he is extremely, in my opinion, extremely even-handed about the West. I mean, he does say good things about it. It's not like it's only the criticism. It's very interesting how, you know, people will, you know, when their egos are being threatened, they ignore all the good stuff that comes their way and focus only on the critical stuff. And that's what a lot of the responses to his Harvard Address did. They ignored all the positive things he said about the freedoms and about how, you know, we don't have gulags and things like that. I mean, like he did point out good things. It's just that he was critical of the West in a way he should have been critical, you know. And, you know, I mean, he talked about how we measure everything on a Western yardstick. And this is an idea that is, if I'm not mistaken, echoed many years later by Samuel Huntington in The Clash of Civilizations, that great work he did in the 90s, I believe. We don't, just because something works for the West doesn't mean it's right for, say, the Islamic world or for sub-Saharan Africa or for Asia or what have you. He also talks about the reduction in civic courage. And yeah, that to me is a big deal. I mean, before I even had anything to do with the dissident right and all this, and I was just kind of like a race realist college student that kept it under wraps mostly, I found the quote from his Harvard Address about the reduction, the loss of civic courage, and I printed it out and put it on my wall, because, you know, I'm like, yeah, this is true. We are terrified of things, terrified of the left. So when, you know, for example, you know, after, say, like the Covington kids were caught on camera doing nothing, basically doing nothing wrong, and their school immediately renounced them.
Yeah, like, Catholic school.
Yeah, I know. And they, because they're terrified, they have no civic courage at all.
This kid had gone to Washington, D.C. to protest abortion.
Right. Yeah, so that's true,
they're,
too.
They're participating in what the Catholic Church should stand up for, and they're immediately thrown on the bus in the face of an immediate accusation of something that was silly, basically no foundation either. So there's no investigation.
Exactly. the way people folded so quickly was just scary. I mean, this is why, I mean, I disagree with someone like Ted Nugent a lot, but I mean, I have to respect the guy for having backbone. You know, he, if he sees the left doing things he doesn't like, he will point it out, and he doesn't care what anybody says, and he could be as obnoxious as he wants to be. He doesn't care. And yeah. I admire that. Because
well, the problem is that what the right does, it immediately accepts the left's moral, you know, their a priori presumptions of where.
Well, they might, you know, they might take a decade to catch up, but yeah. Yes. Yeah. And that's, but they don't call them the right. They're basically conservative liberals. There's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you look at someone like, all right, let's keep the neocons out of it. Let me think of a good example. Who would be a good example? Like the people like Byron York or the people in the National Review.
That
read those guys in a while. I don't. They're conservatives, but I consider them conservative leftists. I don't consider them people on the right unless they take the age-old Christian tradition seriously, in which case they would have to reject gay marriage, they would have to reject tranny stuff, they would have to reject all that other stuff. But when they get weak on all these leftist impulses, then they're turning their back on their Christian roots, which means they were never really part of the right anyway. They were just conservative liberals.
Yeah, they'll write articles, a conservative case for trannies, a conservative case for gay marriage, a conservative case for the Great Replacement.
Right, exactly. And that to me, like, is, they're not on the right. I don't call them the right. They're not the right. You see, I think, you know, you can describe the right in many ways. It's kind of, Jim Godin and I got into this once about it, you know, because he doesn't like using left and right at all, and I do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't quite mean the same that it used to mean. Today, I would say that the best, not, it's not a perfect definition for right and left, but the best definition is, are you pro-white or anti-anti-white, and you mean to stand up for that? If you're pro-white or anti-anti-right white, then you're on the right. If you're not that group, then you're on the left. Now, maybe you're in the middle of the road, but, you know, push comes to shove, you'll be on the left. Yeah. And so that, to me, is the best description of right and left. And Solzhenitsyn actually himself points out he doesn't like the distinctions right and left in the Gulag Archipelago, but that's like one or two sentences. I don't know if he put a whole lot of thought into that and how the term right and left has evolved over time. But I think I find them useful. He was also obsessed with he says that the West was obsessed with materialism. Mm-hmm. And you know, I might push back a little on that because, you know, I guess when you're raised in the Soviet system and then thrown in the gulag after that, you know, if you can have a cup of coffee every morning, that's materialistic. You know, I mean, like,
well, yeah, I had a history professor when I was in college. I was taking Russian history, and he said there was an attitude among Russians to look at Westerners, particularly Americans, and they idolize their own poverty. In America, if you want an orange, you just go get an orange. In Russia, you have to look for an orange.
Right, or wait in line.
Wait in line for it, earn it. Then there's a way I can understand.
Or bribe someone. You have to bribe somebody to get an orange.
Yeah, exactly. You have to bribe someone. That's their way of paying for it. Exactly. Or know somebody.
Exactly.
You know? And right. So that's, yeah. So I can understand that the Russian attitude coming from, you know, after, you know, a century of deprivation, you know, imposed on by communism. Yeah.
Right. Well, when you're raised in a household that has three telephones and the internet and four televisions and a microwave oven and internal heating, internal air conditioning, you know, it's there's no shame in saying I want to maintain that level of comfort and high standard of living. There's no shame in that. And Solzhenitsyn might have missed that one a little, just a little. I mean, it's, yes, you're right. Too much materialism is a bad thing. Just like if you eat too much, it's a bad thing. But, you know, to go after materialism in and of itself might have been a stretch, in my opinion. He also talked about how we're too legalistic. I agree. Although I don't know how else we could be. That's a problem that I don't know if it's one of those necessary evil things or if it's something we can actually work on.
Well, I think the legalism is an interesting case because we see now with lawfare and the corruption of the judicial system and the strategy, you know, like Roberta Kaplan and her activism and she abused the legal system.
Yeah, I mean, there should be there. Maybe there's some ways we can clamp down on that. But that I think is that's not the real reason why people were upset with him. I think that he also is anti-humanist, and that this is the core of his issue with Sakharov, because for a while there, he and Sakharov were thick as thieves, because they were both dissident, you know, dissidents in gulags and stuff. And they were both scientists. They had a lot in common and all. But Sakharov was a humanist. And so he would be more inclined to feel that socialism can work, but the communists messed it up, you know, and he was a liberal at heart, although he was an honest one and a good man. And, you know, he and Solzhenitsyn had a very frosty relationship towards the end. And I think when I forget who died first, I'm pretty sure Sakharov did. When they did have a phone call, like before Sakharov died, and I don't know if they buried the hatchet, but you know, they didn't hate each other. They just had a very tense relationship. Sakharov was very much a humanist, and humanism is a big deal in the United States among the literati, among the press especially. So when you go after humanism and say, hey, you know, I don't mind, well, this is effectively what he said, I don't mind a czar, I don't mind autocrats, as long as they're subservient to God. You know, like that kind of argument, if you say that to a humanist, they're going to bark at you. Like, did you ever read Ayn Rand's response to Solzhenitsyn?
No. But I'm familiar with how she thought.
God, I mean, she is so contemptuously dismissive of him. It was she wrote, or maybe it was a speech, I don't know, but it was very brief assessment. And all she said was, what he said about the camps is true. And then after that, saying he should have no influence at all because he is like an old school religious person. His religion is barbaric, is superstitious. It's basically anti-humanist. And she just really look it up. She really hit on it hard.
Well, both and Sakharov, like, and
that, what?
Were both Sakharov and Ayn Rand, weren't they Jewish?
Ayn Rand was. I don't think Sakharov was.
Okay, but he was involved like in nuclear bomb development in Russia, right? That was it.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, he was a physicist. It's possible. Physicist. Yeah.
But he was also, I think, a pronounced atheist. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, many humanists are atheists. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Ayn Rand, yeah, it's funny. Yeah, she would look at, you know, him as sort of a, you know, something out of a different age or something.
Right. But I mean, it's one thing to disagree respectfully, and it's another thing entirely to just trash him.
Yeah, but she had a problem
after
with
what
that
man went through.
She had a problem with respect to disagreeing with people.
What?
She had a problem respectfully disagreeing with people.
I guess so. Yeah. Well, that's maybe one reason why I don't like her.
Yeah, she created her own cult around her, and she was a strange woman, you know. And,
yes, she was.
And Rand droids themselves, usually, you know, people who are devotees of Ayn Rand, usually between the ages of 18 and 21, then they start to live a little, and they kind of.
I don't think her influence is a bad one overall. I think on the net it's good.
Her insights were good about bureaucracy and, you know, free enterprise, but making a god of it, you know, basically, what the smokestacks are like cathedrals and worshiping industry.
That's a bit much. But yeah. I agree. I mean, but I do think though that she's a good gateway drug, I guess, to libertarianism, and that is a way open to the right.
Well, I think people have to go through a libertarian phase. It's like puberty.
Could be. I mean, I kind of did.
It's intellectual puberty. It's like kind of like you. There are insights into economy and banking and money, the nature of money, and also elite, like Murray Rothbard's research in elite intrigues and scheming is very important. Like World War One and Wall Street, a very good book.
Okay, I'll check it out. Yeah, I've not read any Rothbard. Yeah. Just heard about him.
So, but anyway, we're digressing. So I'll let you continue.
Okay. Well, yeah. So the Harvard Address was a big deal. He did make some interesting predictions. He predicted that the relations with the colonial world would switch to the opposite extreme.
That was funny. I read. Yes, it's this obsequious you know, sort of this worshiping of the brown and black and this derogation.
Yeah, he said that
of
that's going to bite you in the butt later on.
Yeah.
And he said if things don't change, the West will surrender everything it owns. And that's a terrifying prediction because he's telling the truth. I mean, this is correct. And it's scary.
Look at today's border. Yeah.
Southern border,
United States.
No doubt. I know. Yeah.
It's this fetish. It's almost a fetish. Well, obviously it's a plan. So that's kind of, you have people who, organizations that are doing this, people in governmental positions like Mayorkas, you know, who are in charge with not enforcing the law. Then we have this latest bill that the Senate passed, which it's a border bill, but it spends $60 billion on Russia and Israel. I mean, sorry, on Ukraine and Russia. I mean, in Israel, but just nothing for the border.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, our government is in thrall of people who are not Americans, basically. And that is that's bad.
Isn't that is that a consequence of liberalism itself? Or just a risk of COVID? Because you don't have an immune system.
I would say that because you know, when you say that, when you're a liberal, you know, you're not making any kind of distinctions about in-group and out-group, unless the person is traditional minded or conservative or ethno-nationalist, then they're out-group members. But if you're not like that, you know, then if you're not white and not like that, then you're an in-group member. Mm-hmm. And so liberalism doesn't really, it's sort of like a perverted Christianity, that it has the universality of it, you know, it has the universality of Christianity, but without a God. And without the discipline of tradition. And so once you have that, anything's possible. So you could replace, you know, your white steel workers in Pittsburgh with, you know, Somalis who just came off the boat and everything should be fine. You know, I mean, they don't really have a concept of, I guess, ethnos and what that means. And they ignore all evidence that supports that. So if you start talking about IQ differences, if you start talking about psychometrics and things like that, temperament differences, and the data is solid, you know, very solid.
It works as solid as you
can get for social sciences. They ignore it, or they'll condemn it as racist or whatever. So I do think this is all an offshoot of liberalism as a form of warped Christianity. Or a decapitated Christianity.
It takes the cultural, the economic, the technological, political developments, artistic developments of the West. This takes it all for granted. It doesn't see it
like
as
it'll always be here.
And it's something you can just pluck it and feed off of, as opposed to nurture, maintain, and encourage it. Where everything's discouraged in the name of diversity.
Right. So let's have airline pilots and airline engineers, make them as many blacks and females as possible. And what could go wrong? You know, and then we'll find out something will go wrong.
You can have a shuck and jive culture and celebrate it. At the same time, expect that same cohort to produce engineers and architects and mathematicians.
Right.
Well, no, there's a cost to that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that this is what midwits. I'm sorry to have to use the word, but I can't think of a better one. But when, you know, one reason why you have your Spenglerian rise and fall of civilizations is because in a successful, prosperous civilization, midwits find there's many more of them, and they find places for themselves in the bureaucracy and the hierarchy, and they move up, 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 up. And, you know, these are the people who don't realize what you just said, that, you know, it's actually quite a rare thing. If you look at the human history, it's a rare thing that you can have such high levels of trust, that you can have that societies can function so well in the West. And that's because of the painstaking efforts done by people from the bottom to the top, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. Because these are people who were either very dedicated to their brain work, like with engineering or medicine or what have you, or they were willing to be one of those poor souls that would die while building the Empire State Building or the Brooklyn Bridge or something like that. Like, I think there were men who died of the bends when they were building the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yes.
Right. I mean, like, so there were men willing to, I mean, Grant, I know there was self-interest, they were getting paid and they were poor and stuff, but the idea that they were producing work that would make us a civilization greater than it already was, and they were willing to risk, even take a slight risk at their own death to do that. These things cannot be forgotten, but they are now, because when we take for granted that the bridges won't break during a storm, we take for granted that our buildings will remain standing, we take for granted all these other things, you know, and we should never do that.
Yeah, the idea that, of course, this because egalitarianism is sort of this it's an article of faith that everything is equal, but everyday observation means it's not. A good example is just, you know, what you're describing there is the workaday effort that's required not only of a certain ethnic group perhaps, but also sex. I mean, it's male. And
yep.
This is the most of what's created and built, the infrastructure is built by men and designed mostly by Western men, ethnic white men. And the assumption that possibly if you could hold out that a certain cohort of non-whites could engage in this behavior and activity at the similar level, but you're never going to have a proportional representation, and that shouldn't be your goal anyway. Your goal should be the achievement itself, as opposed to making a fetish out of proportional representation. Despite the fact, if you're going to celebrate diversity, really truly celebrate diversity, you got to also accept the reality of there's going to be a diversity in outcomes, because there's a diversity in input.
Right.
I understand.
I mean, celebrating diversity is sort of like celebrating the paint job on your automobile and caring less about whether or not it runs.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in the name of diversity, everything has to be the same. Meaning, obviously, if you really want to celebrate diversity, you're going to enforce borders and allow communities to develop, homogeneous communities to develop.
Diversity doesn't apply to whites. And this is why, you know, there's push to diversify NASCAR and the NHL, but not the NBA or the NFL.
Even though ethnic whites are the most diverse group out there.
What do you mean?
Well, our skin color changes. We have different hair color, different eye color.
Okay. Well, genetically speaking,
yes.
Genetically speaking, sub-Saharan Africans are more diverse among each other than anybody else is.
Because of lack of commingling?
I think because there were only certain waves of people that left or escaped Africa. And so you have a more narrow genetic collection of people that went to Europe or went to Asia or went to anywhere else,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so all the people from Europe or all the Caucasians, all the Semitic people, all the people from Asia, they have a small set of ancestors that escaped Africa and never went back. Whereas Africa has been the same for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And so genetically speaking, a Hottentot, a Hutu, a Nigerian, whatever, Somali, they're all black, but they're more genetically divergent than say a Pole is to a Spaniard or an Irishman, right?
I see what you mean, yeah. But I'm just talking about how they just take for granted. First of all, it's when you say the whole complexity of European civilization, the differences between Germans and French, there's obviously those commingling, especially you get near the border. But this is what produced the Occident, the West. And this is what we call white now, right? It's you know, it's Christendom, it's Europe, and it's everything Western. And that's why, and we call it white, particularly in the United States. It gets more complicated because there's still more ethnic identity based on borders in Europe still, despite efforts of, you know, Barbara Leonard Spector and other NATO and all that. There's still a German and a French and a British identity, Welsh, you know, a Scottish identity that they're trying to destroy with planned mass immigration, replacement migration. But bringing it back to Solzhenitsyn is that he was an ethno-nationalist, or at least he believed in the Russian ethnicity. And he writes about how a similar process occurred in the Soviet Union about attacking Russian identity. And this has sort of been a plan that's been copied in current years in the West. We're going after the incumbent or identity of the West, which is, you know, ethnic white Americans or even Europeans.
Yeah.
There's an attack on that identity.
Yeah, that was the subject of the essay I wrote about the connection between March 1917 and the 2020 during the summer of Floyd and all that. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of eerie similarities there, you know, because Solzhenitsyn really delves into it in his Red Wheel. Describes like quotes from members of the Duma, and describes actions, scenes on the street, and how the news media would have fake news way back then, how they would distort things to promote a leftist agenda or ignore things to promote a leftist agenda. Like, for example, you know, this is something that people forget, at least according to Solzhenitsyn, there was no shortage of bread in what Petersburg during the time of the first revolution in February or March, however you want to look at it.
Yeah.
Although the people on the left say there was, and Solzhenitsyn is like, no, there wasn't. Now there were shortages in the previous year, like in November or whatever, but the conservatives in the Duma and the Tsar really worked at it to make sure that no, we need to get bread here. And they did. And a lot of that loss of bread was the result of hoarding on the part of the left, or they would do strategic strikes in certain areas to make sure that the bread wasn't made or the bread wasn't delivered. I mean, they orchestrated this loss of bread, right, or the shortage of bread. But despite that, bread was available during the time of the revolution, the first revolution. Bread was there. So when people...
It's funny. A similar tactic was used during the French Revolution.
Sorry?
A similar tactic was used during the French Revolution.
Could be. I haven't studied that. I need to look into that. But yeah, I mean, the Bolsheviks were modeling themselves after the French Revolution, but probably more closely to the 48ers. These were the people who were responsible for the 1848, I guess it was the second French Revolution, you know, that caused the Paris Commune. So for a brief time, there was commies in charge of Paris, you know, and it was horrific. I mean, people were starving and stuff. It was really a bad scene. And they did it again, like probably during the Franco-Prussian War as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 1870, the Paris Commune, yeah.
Although there was something going on in 48, though. I don't know.
Oh, there was the revolution in 1848, you know, which was then that's when you had the suppression. That's when all the Germans came to the United States.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that and was then huge there was, right. So then you had the in the 1870s when you had the Paris Commune. And the thing is that a lot of the Bolsheviks looked up to the Paris Commune people. Some of them were still alive at that point.
Yeah. And that was also then, of course, we talk about these Bolsheviks. You had the same thing occur in Germany in the 1920s or in Hungary and in Germany, you know, which you had the reaction with National Socialism.
People don't realize that there was
Kurt Eisner.
Eisner tried to take over part of Bavaria and make it a Soviet republic. And because some German veterans of the war stopped him at the last minute.
The Freikorps, yeah.
Okay, yes, that's who they were. And yeah, I don't know enough. I don't know very much about Bela Kun in Hungary, but yeah, that was another bad scene. I think he was much more successful.
Yeah, they set it up, the Bela Kun Republic, and they immediately started a cultural Marxist agenda, promoting sexual degeneracy.
And yeah, they were like turning churches into cinema houses and stuff,
They were chased out, and they went to Germany. And then they were chased out and they went to Columbia and Hollywood in the United States.
Right. That makes sense.
Where they found a much more, ironically, a much more hospitable environment in the United States. Free capital.
Yeah. So did the Frankfurt School people.
Yep. 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 And that's the weakness there. So there's that. I mean, so you have this, you know, Solzhenitsyn is writing about this, the weakness of the West. And he's offering a warning, actually. It's a warning. You have a chapter, Warning to the West, and one of the later chapters,
right?
And I think you speak of sort of, I think you talk about obsolete Enlightenment ideas, I think was the term you used, or something.
Yeah, that he Solzhenitsyn was very suspicious of the Enlightenment,
as we all should.
Yeah,
it's bad definitely. Anthropology, it's bad theology, it's bad philosophy.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is that the Enlightenment. Are you there? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. The Enlightenment works well for white people. Okay. So if everybody on the planet were white, or maybe East Asian as well, the Enlightenment is great. You know,
it's funny. I made the observation. I think I don't know if I've made this observation or heard the observation. Nevertheless, I think it says that you know, a colorblind society only works if it's all white.
Right, exactly, because only white people are willing to do that.
Yeah.
but yeah, I mean, like, you know, if we were to, I mean, knock on wood, if this ever happens, if, you know, wherever to form our white ethno state in North America, you know, the first thing I would want to do is keep the Constitution as close as possible to how it is now, and mm-hmm. just introduce some key elements about immigration and about ethnocentrism, about the white majority and things like that, but then keep the rest the same. Although mm-hmm. I would probably do away with the first half of the Second Amendment, because that is an annoying phrase, in my opinion. You know, because I do support gun rights, and I don't think you need to have a reason for it. You just, if you can keep and bear arms at the end. But aside from that, you know, I would want to keep it as close as possible to the Constitution, and the Constitution is an Enlightenment document. Mm-hmm. It really is. But when you have an all-white society, or a society that's, you know, 90-95% white and is normatively white, as Greg Johnson likes to describe it, then the Enlightenment is fine. It's
well,
just
what you have is you have liberal institutions, liberal political customs or functions, a constitution, a Congress, basically a Congress, two houses, one's appointed, one's popularly elected. In the state level, you have an executive, which is elected by electoral college. Supreme Court, that's supposedly judicial, appointed by responsible politicians to oversee and check each other. All this kind of balances that, but all that kind of works if it's set atop a you know, sort of a traditional hierarchical society. And that's where religion and culture comes into play. So you can have these liberal institutions that are effectively superficially lay on top a blood and soil traditional hierarchical society, which isn't being subjected to cultural ethnic warfare or social programming, right. Social engineering. And this is where you talk, these are all things kind of function in a white society that isn't being manipulated and undermined by an alien minority it's very ethnocentric. And this is where
exactly
perhaps 200 right. years together comes into play, his book.
Right.
Which isn't quite as celebrated or known in the West for some reason.
Well, one thing I want to point out before we go to 200 years together is that in the Warning to the West chapter, I did point out that there are many places in Warning to the West where you can you could just cross out Russian and put in white,
mm-hmm.
and everything still works.
Yeah.
And that's a point that, you know, if you look at Solzhenitsyn and a lot of his nonfiction, you can look at that and you can just replace Russian, like the as an adjective, you know, like Russian person to white person, and everything makes sense to today, which is eerie.
Well,
it really is.
This is something, you get something that transcends culture or different societies. So you have the West, which became decreasingly ethnocentric and more liberal and became more radicalized. And now it's on a precipice of disaster because of that. Totally. Ethnocentric cultures are inherently conservative, despite the ideology. A good example would be Russia. The ethnocentric Russian is essentially, Russia is now a conservative entity or phenomenon.
Well, keep in mind, that's not quite, I mean, that's true, but there's also the element that the Russians are multicultural. And by that, I mean multiracial. So they have a lot of people that are not white that are being treated very well there too. Not to say that they shouldn't be, but my point is that the Russians, it's not like it's all white people there.
But isn't it like 80% though?
That's about right, yeah.
So
that's what it was in around 1980 in America.
Yeah, there's a tipping point to these things. There's a
true.
Basically, there's a tipping point. There's a critical mass, might be a word you might use for, you know, talking about certain ethnic groups, where it's manageable. And if if there's an acknowledgement of the ethnic majority as being something worth preserving, defending, and promoting, then it works. Same with China, despite Maoism and communism. For better or for worse, the Communist Party represents ethnic Chinese. And from a certain perspective, it's conservative. Same with Russia, where they don't get by into all the cultural Marxist nonsense. They recognize it as something as a weakness. That's why Chinese now are promoting cultural Marxism in the West. They like promoting it because they know it weakens the West. It weakens the United States. Same with Putin, if you give some of his address, I haven't watched the recent interview with Tucker Carlson. Putin, I haven't had a chance yet. But if you listen to what Putin says, his utterances, he's a politician, you know, just take it for, take his word, you know, take him at his word. His critique of the West is accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard his critiques of the West. I agree with them.
My thing is, there is one of the reasons why Russia and Putin are hated by those who control the West now is his apparent ethnocentrism. And so,
He stands for the old right.
Yes,
in many ways, and that's something that the neocons really detest. In the same way that Ayn Rand detested Solzhenitsyn, it's very similar. And by the way, Solzhenitsyn met with Putin. 2004, I think.
You got a medal, yes.
No, actually, they hung out. I mean, I think Putin went to Solzhenitsyn's house and they
hung out and talked.
They hung out. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just an awarding of a medal, you know.
Well, like I said, okay, I listen to translations for Putin's speeches, and they're far more substantive and deep than anything uttered by a Western politician in the last 40 years.
Really?
I mean, I haven't heard anything insightful. He comments on culture, these things. You don't hear anything in the West speaking the way that Putin does, if I can trust the translation.
I mean, right.
Now, again, there's one thing that this is a problem. Again, one of the reasons why I think Russia is now, the enemy again, is because of what it represents geopolitically, its place on the map. This gets back to the Mackinder Doctrine. They own, the Eurasia landmass being controlled by the sea powers. That's the American, Anglo-American Zio Empire, which seeks to continually hegemony, because that's the only way it can maintain its control of the world, is through manipulation, deceit, and perfidy.
Yeah.
It can't compete with these competing trading blocks, which Russia and China threaten. Now, a lot of intrigue there. I don't want to get into that right now. But the point is that reason why Putin became the enemy, at least in my estimation, is because he reestablished the Russian state's control over these oligarchs. In the West, we haven't been able to maintain control of our oligarchs. So now we're under control of an oligarchy. Despite being liberal, we're more oligarchical than ever.
That's true. You're absolutely right about that. And this is how tyranny can kind of sneak in through the back door, because, an oligarch won't call attention to himself, and yet will buy politicians and control politicians to implement, all sorts of bad things. And yet, they can say, well, they have a right to do that because they're not government. Well, they're controlling the government.
It doesn't speak to Solzhenitsyn's critique of the West of materialism, because if we worship the dollar, we worship mammon, that becomes our God, despite the First Amendment and having no official
religion. That's true. I mean, if you are... materialistic in the sense that your material comfort comes first, then you'll never be a dissident.
You won't have any courage.
Yeah, right. Because you're concerned about your bank account. You're concerned about your 401k. You're concerned about there's some justice in that. You have a family. You have kids. You want to make sure you can pass on your wealth. I mean, so it's not like they're immoral for trying to look out for number one, but at the same time, when you don't have a sense of duty in life, which is another thing that Solzhenitsyn likes to pound through, is the fact that, when you don't have a sense of duty towards your greater people, then, you're only thinking of yourself, and that's wrong. I mean, you should be able to mix it up. And actually the, what's his name? Frank Salter writes about this in his indispensable on genetic interests, where he actually creates a metric. I'm actually trying to find it now, where there's a certain level of self-interest, and then interest for your family, and then interest for your ethnicity, and then interest for all humanity. And I forget what he calls it, but he has these graphs in this book that shows how under Nazism or under communism or under capitalism, these different you have different lines on a chart that would say they're called fitness portfolios. Mm-hmm. And so you would have columns of self, offspring, ethnic, and humanity. And so for liberalism, or for capitalism, self is very high and everything else is very low. With Nazism, self is kind of low, but ethnic is very high, you know, that kind of thing. And it's very interesting. So I do recommend On Genetic Interests to take a look at his fitness portfolios. But anyway, you wanted to talk about 200 years together.
Well, first, let me just say that both capitalism and communism, I think, sought to deracinate. I think capitalism was far more successful in deracinating people, denying them their ethnic ties and roots, their sort of bonds that tie people together. And there's the capitalism and basically product and marketing replaces the cultural ethnic identity. The material opportunity offered by capitalism creates a very mobile cosmopolitan society. A rootless society, which is easily manipulated and easily undermined.
Yeah, I mean, there's truth in that. The interesting thing I read recently and reviewed Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, mm-hmm. and one of the messages I got from that book, or one of the one of my readings, is that libertarianism is anti-tribalism. It's you know, if you're a tribalist, if you're a true tribalist, then libertarianism isn't going to make much sense to you. And if you're a libertarian, then tribalism won't make much sense, because, you know, you don't care who makes your pencil, you don't care what their skin color is, you don't care who gives you the service, as long as it's good service, as long as you get, you know, your money's worth, whatever, because yeah. You're always thinking about me, right? So yeah, there's that. I don't know. I mean, capitalism does. The thing about capitalism, the reason why I don't really like rail against it that much, is because it does do what it says it's supposed to do. You know, it's supposed to increase prosperity, and it's supposed to, you know, make us richer. And maybe it has all these negative things too, which it doesn't address. But under a capitalist society, people can eat whenever they want, and they don't have, even the poor aren't starving. The poor are overweight.
They have diabetes.
Well, yeah, okay, fine. But I mean, you know, I know stories from the Soviet Union from the 1950s, yes, where people were still, these were working people, were hungry. They yes. were hungry, and they didn't know when their next loaf of bread was coming. You know, I mean, like, I would rather take the risk on diabetes than face starvation.
Well, that's right? The internal temptation of man. It's the city of man versus the city of God, St. Augustine's thing. Which is it? Now, there's a balance there, of course, because most people have to meet their material needs, even to support the spiritual. I mean, they have to have earned something to donate to the church, to give something to the collection plate. And there's obviously, this is the importance of balance. My point is why would someone like a Milton Friedman, a Jewish economist, supposed libertarian, although some of his work with the government would contradict that. I think withholding tax was Milton Friedman's idea. 1943. He was a bureaucrat in the Department of Treasury. He came up with that idea. And nevertheless, he's free to choose. It's libertarianism is a war on tribalism, but it's advocated by many people who belong to a very ethnocentric tribe. They also advocate communism too.
They don't, and that's something that Friedman doesn't address, or at least he didn't in the book that I read, and anything else that I've read by him. He doesn't talk about that, and that to me indicates there might be some shenanigans going on. I don't know,
my point is that the capitalist system that produces this abundance and well being, it may work, but at the same time, the people that are engaging in this is ethnic whites, be they Protestants or Catholics, have to be keen to covert psychological warfare and ethnic
Agreed.
Scheming, and that's something
Agreed.
That the United States was very blind to. Is the hidden grammar of the United States is ethnic warfare, Protestant, Agreed. Catholic, Jew. And it turns out the Protestants and Catholics, although they had their differences, weren't quite as antagonistic as the third group, for obvious
right.
reasons. And right. so that's where something with the West, with, you know, it's called the 20th century is called the Jewish century for a reason. And they call it, Yuri Sluskin wrote that book for a reason. And they boast about their ascendancy in the 20th century. Now, of course, Solzhenitsyn writes this book 200 years together. This is the Russian experience, which you equate. I'm gonna let you talk and go on, but you talk about 200 years together, and he talks about the Russian experience, but then you talk about the American and Western experience, and how, what relevance does his observations have today in the West in 200 years together?
Well, I mean, it is, you can't overstate how important that book is. It's on the level of, you know, The Culture of Critique. It's on the level of, you know, anything by Greg Johnson or Jared Taylor. You know, it's maybe even more. I don't know. He basically names the Jew in the entire book, but he does so with the aim of friendship and with the aim of mutual understanding. Now, this is a point that he raises, although not with Jews, but he does raise it in From Under the Rubble, where he's willing to look at the faults of Russians vis-a-vis, say, the Poles, which there's a lot of bitterness there, believe it or not. I mean, maybe not today, but historically, there's quite a bit of bitterness between Poles and the Russians. And he states in From Under the Rubble, I'm willing to, you know, look at our side and talk about all the bad things we did, but I can't be the only one doing that. You have to do it as well. And he was referring to the Poles, but this is his way of taking that same attitude and applying it to the Jews, saying, you guys are not innocent. He has tremendous respect for the Jews. He's a Zionist. He had no issue with Jews going to Israel. He had no problems with that whatsoever. And as a principled ethno-nationalist, it would be hypocritical for him to, you know, say, you know, ethno-nationalism for me and not for thee. Although that's what many Jewish people say.
Yeah. But
despite that, he, you know, he's opening his hand for in friendship and saying, look, this criticism comes from a place of love. And there are passages in 200 Years Together where he's so nice to Jews, where he's saying all these wonderful things, you know. But of course, like I said before, when your ego is being impugned, you don't look at the good, you only look at the bad. Just like when the journalists got their panties in a bunch over the Harvard address, and they ignored all the nice things he said about the West. You know, the many Jews are going to say, well, it doesn't matter if he's saying nice things, he's an anti-Semite, which is completely unfair, because I believe Solzhenitsyn meant every word he said. That's another thing I want to bring up before I continue, is that one reason why Solzhenitsyn is such a valuable source for the dissident right is that he is an impeccable source. There's no self-interest here. He could have, like I said, he could have quit at any point and lived a fine life at his own Dhaka in Russia somewhere, enjoying the fruits of whatever success he could get, which the Soviets were willing to heap upon him if he was only willing to play ball, but he didn't. And he had nothing to gain. As a matter of fact, he made sure of it through his publisher that he would make that the Gulag Archipelago would be cheap. And I actually have my paperbacks are from the 70s and they're like $2.95 or $1.95. They're just dirt cheap, you know, and he put that in his contract, and that the proceeds to that book, those three volumes went to relief for survivors of the Gulag. So Solzhenitsyn as a source, in my opinion, is impeccable. You can disagree with him, but you can't call him a liar. You can't say that he is the kind of person that would have any kind of ulterior motive. So that being said, when you look at 200 Years Together, you can take it as an honest testimony towards how many Jewish individuals ruined Russia, basically conquered it in 1917 when they didn't even need to, because he makes a very good point that the provisional government, for all its weaknesses, was not anti-Semitic at all. They made it against the law to be anti-Semitic, right? It was they were very Jew-friendly. So the Jewish terrorists and radicals had really no good reason to topple Kerensky's government except through the wanton power lust, which is basically what Lenin and Stalin and all of them were succumbing to. But the brilliance of 200 Years Together is that, you know, he goes through and he just names all these Jews. So, for example, the financiers, Jacob Schiff, the Rothschilds and Baron Ginsburg, Armand Hammer. I mean, these were Jewish Western financiers that gave millions to the Soviet Union when they were committing their most horrific atrocities. And it's funny how many of the same people started bellyaching like 15 years later when in the 1930s, when the Nazis were cracking down on the left and many Jews were getting caught in the crossfires and they were like bellowing about human rights, but yet they were silent during this horrific period of the 1920s when just millions of people were being killed. Then, you know, he talks about the Red Army and how it was run by Trotsky, and Ephraim Skylansky is another one. Yakov Sverdlov. I mean, these were all his Jewish lieutenants. He quotes somebody named Schwartz talking about wanting to commit genocide against Russians back then. Now, another thing that's interesting is that he mentions this in his memoirs. It's fascinating. He brings up a tremendous amount of anti-Russian literature being spewed from the pens of the second, I think it's called like the second wave of Russian immigrants. The first wave came as a result of World War II, or maybe World War I. No, I think, yeah, World War I and World War II, like in the prior half of the 20th century. But the second half started in the late 1950s, when the Russians started to reassert themselves vis-a-vis the Jews after the death of Stalin. And they started denying Jewish opportunities in many places. And Jews were pissed. And many of them just bolted for Israel or the United States. And they could not stop bellyaching about how bad the Russians were, you know, despite the fact that they were, you know, complicit in murdering so many of them just decades earlier. And so Solzhenitsyn points out that during this time, the anti-Russian literature coming from these people was just venomous. And yet the Jewish critics of Solzhenitsyn don't talk about that. They only talk about, oh, the quote-unquote anti-Semitism of 200 years together, which is a joke compared to some of the things that Solzhenitsyn quotes in his memoirs and in 200 years together. And so, I don't know, I mean, there's quite a few things I learned from this book. And one, ironically, is to, you know, to dial back your Jew hate. And this is something that I kind of got in trouble for, like in January and late December recently, because I wrote about the Jewish right shift. And I hadn't gone through my notes until afterwards. And I realized, oh, you know, the all-consuming Jew hate harmed the white army, or the white armies, plural, because during the Russian Civil War, you had the Russian White Army, and they were for the most part disciplined, and they didn't trust Jews. They didn't allow Jews into positions of power, but some would either ignore them or they would allow them to work in a subsidiary way, because there were quite a few Jewish officers that hated the Reds and that really wanted to fight the Reds. And the white Russians legitimately were saying, we don't trust you guys, but if you want to help out, you can, or just stay out of the way. And that's fine. And there were a very small number of pogroms caused by this group of the white armies. But then you had the Ukrainian white armies that were a different group. They were fighting both the Russians and, or they had convergent interests with the Russians, but they were definitely fighting the Reds. But they wanted a Ukraine that was independent. They hated the Jews. And that, I think part of it was because there were so many Jews in Ukraine, like in Kiev and places like that.
And the exploitation that was common there with the alcohol and other vices.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Famines would get started and stuff because they would be dedicating the grain towards the alcohol and not making bread. But so they hated the Jews, and they were very pro-pogrom. Now, don't get me wrong. The Red Army also committed anti-Russian pogroms. And so we're talking deaths in the hundreds of thousands on both sides. Okay, so the whole thing was a complete mess. But according to Solzhenitsyn, the people who were most deserving, or most moral, most disciplined people were the Russian whites. And they were the ones that did not get the funding that, say, Winston Churchill was trying to get them, because Churchill at the time was not prime minister, but he was a bigwig in the parliament of England, and he wanted to give Western support to the whites, and he couldn't do it because there were so many of these pogroms that the Jewish leftist press was spinning against the conservative elements in England. And so, you know, therefore, and also there were quite a few Jews in England at the time too that would not support the whites under any circumstance. So this is really sad. So if the white armies had more discipline in their approach towards Jewish people and not just want to kill them or just have this horrific rhetoric, then they might have gotten farther. They might have actually had better support from the West, because it was the propaganda war. It's just really bad optics, because that's one thing you have to recognize. This is my reading. Solzhenitsyn doesn't say this, but my reading of his chapters on the Civil War is that you have to recognize that the the Jewish left is the heart of the news media, and they're brilliant at propaganda. Mm-hmm. And if you just say, "Oh no, no, we don't need propaganda," you know, then you're going to lose. I liken it to like a boxer who's been knocked out a few times going up against a young up and comer with a lot of power, and he goes, "Yeah, I'll test my chin on that power. Yeah, I'll let him hit me. It's fine. I could take it. I'll go slug with him 1-on-1. Yeah, it'll be fine." Nuh-uh. No, you have to recognize that Jews in the left, in the media, are brilliant when it comes to propaganda. And you can't give them, you have to give them as little opportunity as possible. And that's what the white armies did, the Russian white armies. Rangel, I think, is the one of the main generals. But the Ukrainians didn't pay attention to that, and therefore they got slaughtered in the battleground of propaganda in the West. And that was one reason why it was difficult for conservative people to marshal funds from governments to help the whites. So, You know, Solzhenitsyn likes to second guess a lot. And I mean, I should say Monday Morning Quarterback, a lot of what happened back then. And he's saying, well, if this had been different, if that had been different, things wouldn't have happened. And this is one of the things. So that's one thing I wanted to put in there. But also, you know, Solzhenitsyn goes on about the OGPU, which was run by a Polish guy. I'm blanking on his name at the moment. Dzierżynski or something like that.
Yeah, Dzierżynski. It was the Cheka or something like that. Yeah.
Right. That became the Cheka later. But Dzierżynski,
he was an ethnic Pole. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was Polish. He was one of the top guys, but he was the top guy. But all his, like three of his four lieutenants were Jews. Benjamin Gerson, and a guy named Lutsky. And then, of course, Stalin always, even though he was, you know, people call him anti-Semitic, and, you know, there's a book I've read by Lewis Rappaport, which I reviewed for the Occidental Observer, called Stalin's War Against the Jews. You know, there's all this stuff about Stalin hating Jews, but he kept quite a few Jews close to his chest, including Kaganovich, Lev Mekhlis, another guy named Moses, I'm trying to read his name, it's hard to read these names.
Well, I think
Ronovich, I think his name is.
Yeah, the accusation of Stalin's anti-Semitism stems from the original purges, where he was purging this first generation of Bolsheviks who were just overwhelmingly Jewish. So the victims were Jewish. Trotsky.
Right. And it happened again in the Karin, late 50s, yeah. I mean, late 40s as well.
The doctor's plot, right?
Yep. The doctor's plot was another one. That's true.
Was there a plot?
Oh golly!
But my point is, if you're a dictator, there's a reason why dictators are paranoid.
right. I don't know. I don't know if there was a real plot or not. I kind of doubt it.
But... I thought his thing was there was this because you had Israel that was created, which originally had the backing of the Soviet Union.
I'll tell you what happened. I don't know if this is discussed in Solzhenitsyn or if it was discussed in Stalin's War Against the Jews. But what basically happened was who was the first female prime minister of Israel?
Golda Meir,
before she was prime minister, visited Russia, visited the Soviet Union in like 48 or whenever it was, mm-hmm. like after World War II, after Israel was established, and Stalin was offended. And I will not take Stalin's side on a ton of things, but I can kind of see where he would be a little biffed about this, because she shows up and the Russian Jews go bonkers. They love her. They're giving her a parade or whatever it was. I mean, their support for Israel and for Golda Meir was just off the charts.
Yes, and for someone of Stalin's personality, it's not a good thing.
No, Stalin is like, wait a minute, what the hell? This is a foreign leader from a foreign country. Why are you showing dual loyalty here? I thought you were Soviets. I thought you were on our side.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And that kind of that sort of turned him against.
Well, I'm saying, was Stalin paranoid to think that the Jews within the Soviet Union might have primary loyalty to the Jewish state as opposed to the Soviet state? I mean, look at America today.
I don't know if that's paranoia, is it?
Look at America.
To say that Blinken feels that way?
Look at Senator Schumer. He's a Schumer for Israel.
Yeah, I don't think
my job is
at all.
To defend Israel. My job is to defend Israel first.
Right.
Proud of that. Then why are you in the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, exactly. You don't belong here. But so therefore, it's not paranoid to say that. And it's not. Wait, by the way, it wasn't. We're not talking about Jewish members of the Communist Party who are working with the government. We're talking about also talking about just main people, regular people here, citizens. Okay.
Yes.
So I mean, there's that. But you know, he Solzhenitsyn would. Oh my God! I mean, he talks about the Holodomor in the 200 Years Together. He has a chapter on the gulags, which basically focuses on the Jewish element. Now, in Gulag Archipelago, Jews are mentioned, but Jews qua Jews are not mentioned much, very little, as a matter of fact. And the thing is that the funny thing is that after Gulag Archipelago, there were these murmurs among the Jewish community that Solzhenitsyn was anti-Semitic, but there wasn't anything like deliberate, anything that was like over the top, because he had Jewish friends. He, like that fellow Reuben in his plays and in the First Circle, was based on a real person who was Jewish that he was buddies with. And he had, you know, as I think his wife is half Jewish or a quarter Jewish, I think half Jewish. So like, you know, and his, of course, his behavior was impeccable. He was never, ever saying anything ugly about anyone. And so, you know, the people were beginning to wonder, is he anti-Semitic based on some of the depictions of Jewish people in Gulag? Which he doesn't really go out and say, but they're there. Like, for example, the Belomor Canal wasted over 100,000 people working on it. 100,000 Czechs were killed working on that canal, which ended up being, I think, a failure in the end. And he shows a photograph of a book that was published in the 1930s about celebrating the successful completion of the Belomar Canal. And the photograph in the book lists like five or six people, shows photographs of five or six people who were responsible for this great success. Right? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. And they were all Jews. They were all Jews. And the Soviets were promoting this as a good thing. Not that they were Jews, but that they successfully created the Belomar Canal. And, you know, you had all the top people and here they are. And let's give them all the credit they deserve. La, la, la. You know, and then later on, you know, from the Gulag, he starts, he reproduces this photograph. And this photograph, he actually has a picture of it in the Gulag Archipelago, both the abbreviated version of it, abridged version, as well as the original version. And it's got, I'm reading it now, Sergei Zhuk, Natalie Frenkel, Yakov Rapoport, Matvey Berman. There's another one named Lazar Kogan. I wonder if that's Lazar Kaganovich. I don't think it is, but it's similar name. And then there's Yenrik Yagoda. These are photographs that he didn't compile this. He just cribbed from the original document celebrating the Belomar Canal. And then they have the nerve to call him anti-Semitic. Well, look, you're singling out the Jews. And he's like, I didn't do it. The Soviets did it. It's not me. What are you talking about? You know, and
well, what's that expression? Every single time.
Yeah. And the thing is that he goes into also his prison plays, which I have to say are of, you know, differing quality. Yeah. But it's very, especially Love Girl and the Innocent are very instructive on how he feels about things. And many of the bad guys in Love Girl and the Innocent were Jews. And he didn't really bother to hide the fact that they were Jews. Although in 200 Years Together, he states very clearly that there were a couple Jews that he made into non-Jews because he was worried about being called an anti-Semite. So he left some Jewish characters in there and then converted some other Jews into non-Jewish characters, and yet he gets called anti-Semitic anyway. And he's like, well, I can't win here, you know? I mean, that's a point he makes in 200 Years Together.
This is the problem, is that term anti-Semitism is not defined. It basically, they define it as criticism of Jews, any and all, or recognition of Jewish influence of power good or bad.
Right.
I mean,
well, the,
I mean, a good example is you talk about the canal thing and all the Jews involved in the building that was, which consumed 100,000 lives. And so if they're going to brag about Jewish involvement in its completion, you have to take responsibility for its true cost. Same thing with Hollywood. If you say, you know, Hollywood is Jewish controlled, that's anti-Semitic, then Hollywood Jews will brag about controlling and the necessity of controlling Hollywood. They'll say Jews, Jews are instrumental in promoting gay rights and gay marriage. And if you criticize Jews for promoting this degenerate agenda, you're an anti-Semite. But they've taken credit for it. Jews' role right. in pornography. Yeah, Jews are key in litigating and expanding First Amendment rights and promoting pornography as a in terms of freedom. They see it as freedom. But if you see it as a degenerate agenda and you criticize, the degenerate effect of pornography, then you're an anti-Semite. But nevertheless, the Jewish role in promoting it is an established fact.
Oh, and they'll also deny their role or downplay it.
Depending on the context.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. This double standard, this chameleon-like attitude that they have is offensive.
Yeah.
So like, for example, I remember reading, maybe it was the New York Times, I'm not sure, but one of the major news organs of the United States was highlighting, it's the headline was something like, "Meet the old Jewish couple responsible for gay porn." Okay. And it's just like this puff piece.
Yeah.
I used to work for a newspaper and my editor would call it something else, but I won't repeat it, but anyway, it was a puff piece about how wonderful these two old Jews are for creating all this gay porn.
Yeah. I just saw a thing the other day where National Public Radio had a thing where they're saying that the efforts to convince young men to reject porn and stop masturbating can lead to extremist views. It's a gateway to extremism. So getting control of your life, being responsible, being able to pair a bond and have a relationship with a healthy relationship with women, which you can't get with pornography and masturbating, that's you're edging towards extremism, which, by the way, is right out of the authoritarian personality.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's the authoritarian personality by what, Horkheimer, is that his name?
Yeah, that's the American Jewish Committee saying that if you live a healthy lifestyle or you have an intact nuclear family with a father figure who's an authority figure and a nurturing mother, that leads to fascism.
Right. It's similar to how you would say, they would say, well, if you expect people you work with to be on time, that's racist.
And at the same time, you expect them to be a bit pilots and engineers and not have an attitude towards like being exact and being a perfectionist. Well, all that engineering and technology requires perfectionism for it to work. I mean, you need perfectionism in math for a bridge not to collapse.
Right. But, what's also interesting is that when an ethnicity is good at something, they have really, really high standards.
Yes.
So blacks would be opposed to affirmative action in basketball.
Yes.
They would be opposed to affirmative action in jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless the white cat can really play,
yes,
they're not going to want to, sprinkle non-blacks into jazz groups or whatever, because that's what they're good at. That's what they really have their genius. That's part of their genius.
Yeah, so improvisation.
They don't want to dilute that. Oh, but when it comes to engineering and building airplanes, oh, fuck it. Excuse me. But you know what I mean? It's when you have when it's something that white people do, that's OK. You can insert all sorts of unqualified people into there. That's totally fine. What could go wrong?
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, I think 200 years together is a magnificent work.
But you say he's too nice. You're saying, his appeal that acknowledge what you do wrong, let's find common ground and work together. The problem is the other party isn't receptive to that because of their Talmudic outlook on life.
Could be. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that the work is perfect. Because yes, it does go into that.
My point is, you need some serious pushback as of now to get them to stop being so arrogant. I mean, what we're seeing now is chutzpah. They're being, and particularly in the past 6 months, since October 7th, boy, I mean, it really is over the top now. It's almost undeniable. The point is that if after so many centuries, they still can't see that they have to work. This alien minority group has to work with the majority group in good faith, and they haven't yet. When are they going to see
that? Exactly. No, I agree. I mean, I do state in the book that, in many ways, today's dissident right is like Bert and Solzhenitsyn is like Ernie. You know, I mean, because I remember watching when my kids were young, you know, Ernie would be so optimistic about, the one bad guy in a movie or whatever. And Bert is like, well, you know, Ernie's like, well, maybe he'll change. And Bert's like, well, don't you think he would have done it by now? So I do make that point. But I still love the book and I still love Solzhenitsyn. I mean, but yeah, I do agree that he doesn't have the same attitude that we should have today, but it's a good starting point for sure. Mm. And as far as the imprimatur of or I should say as a source, he's impeccable. So if you're gonna argue with someone about this who's not red-pilled or not familiar with the Jewish question, and you say, well, Solzhenitsyn writes this and Solzhenitsyn writes that, they're gonna have a heck of a time trying to argue with you, because you could bring up Kevin McDonald all you want and no one's heard of him, or yeah, a few people have outside of the dissident right and people like Steven Pinker, but I mean, aside from them, nobody knows who he is. And so that's not a very useful thing beyond our circles.
Well, obviously you name someone like Kevin McDonald, he's kind of what is he famous for, infamous for? So with a normie or a midwit, he's that anti-Semitic guy. Solzhenitsyn, however, if he doesn't know who he is, exactly, they probably won't even know who he is, because it's dynamic silence with most of these people. But Solzhenitsyn, he has this sort of a cachet or value because he was this dissident Russian. He's known as a moral philosopher. Right,
exactly.
So basically his views on these things and sort of transcending communism and capitalism and commenting on society. So what he said, they see him as a good faith moral philosopher. So Gulag Archipelago, his comments on Western society, corrupt Western society, may not agree with it, but it's valid.
Agree, 100%.
You can't just dismiss him. But then he has his 200 years together where he repeats a lot of the criticism of the dissident right towards Jews. What do you have to say
about
that?
And he validates the dissident right.
He validates the dissident right. So that's.
I'm sorry to actually have to say that, because the dissident right should validate itself.
Yeah.
And I'm not 100% sure that Solzhenitsyn would be on board with today's dissident right. I think he would appreciate. David Duke says that he met with Solzhenitsyn. So maybe he would. I don't know. I do think that he does validate us in many ways, and that's why 200 years together is a great resource for people getting started with the Jewish question. And I will add he had a friend that went a little further, and that friend is Igor Shafarevich. Mm-hmm. And Shafarevich has an essay in From Under the Rubble. And he also has a great book called The Socialist Phenomenon, where he talks about the heretical nature of socialism and how poisonous it is and how it's been that way for many, many, many years. Even before the Jewish question became a thing, because there were socialist elements in Christendom, there were many inquisitions against heretical or Gnostic movements that would promote free love and changing of gender roles and yeah, communism and socialism. And some of them get very, very bloody. When we think of the Inquisition, we only think of one, like the one that happened in Spain, which, by the way, involved the Jews and the Muslims. So that's why everybody knows about it, because the Jews and the Muslims won't shut up about it. There were Inquisitions all over the place in Europe where white people were killing other whites.
Yeah, because they were with the Reformation, yeah.
Well, before the Reformation, yeah, too. I mean, this was all Catholic on. This was like the Vatican saying, okay, these communists who've taken over this town and run out the elders and killed all these people and started instituting communism and free love, they got to go because they're a threat. And so they would raise an army and take them out. And that would be an Inquisition. So this is what Shafarevich talks about. And then he wrote a book called the 3,000-year enigma, I think, or something like that. And that is only in Russian. I have the Russian copy, mm-hmm, but and it's basically his version of 200 years together, except it goes deeper and is more critical of Jews. And you really can't find a translation of it. I had Kevin McDonald translate some of his essays. So if you look up Shafarevich on the Occidental Observer, you'll have a few passages, a few essay worth of his issues with the Jews. But it's some interesting stuff. I mean, he was good friends with Solzhenitsyn for many years. He wrote a piece called Russophobia, which was very much critical of Jews. But the difference was, is that Solzhenitsyn was one of those people who believed that those Jews that get criticized are not real Jews. They're the ones who, you know, go against their own traditions. They go against their own religion. And if you support your own religion and your own people and you're a Zionist, then you won't be as bad. And Shafarevich is more along the lines of, no, there's something wrong with Judaism. And like there was a book I read and reviewed for the Occidental Observer called Jewish History, Jewish Religion by Israel Shahak. Mm-hmm. And the subtitle is The Weight of 3,000 Years. And that one is basically impugning Judaism from the core, right? By going into the Talmud and going into other ancient sources and describing how just degenerate the religion is to begin with. And Shafarevich goes there, maybe not as much as Shahak does, but he kind of goes there, whereas Solzhenitsyn would never do that. And that's why after Russophobia was published in the 80s, I believe, Shafarevich, Solzhenitsyn never defended him. He never went against him, but he didn't defend him, because Shafarevich, who, by the way, at that time was a world-renowned mathematician. And if you go on eBay and you look up Igor Shafarevich, you will find a ton of his textbooks. Okay, he was a top-notch, one of the 20th century's greatest mathematicians. And Solzhenitsyn was very close with him for a long time. And then there was a kind of silent break there between the two. I read a biography of Shafarevich, so nobody's 100% sure what happened, but it was kind of a shame that Solzhenitsyn would not come to his friend's aid. And we think it's because his friend attacked the Jewish religion, which Solzhenitsyn never does. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's because Solzhenitsyn is also religious, and I don't think he has a, you know, I think he it's there's levels to this.
Yeah. Well, it's an important critique or criticism. One thing, ironically, is the group that critiques everybody else doesn't think they should be critiqued at all. That's that Jewish solipsism, meaning they should be immune from all criticism, and all Jewish issues should be interpreted through their eyes, not anyone else.
Exactly.
That's a big problem right there.
Americans, at the very least, to look through life through a Jewish lens.
And Americans largely do now because of the past 100 years.
And when you take those lenses off, things are in such better relief, and you realize, oh.
Yes.
Oh, I get it. Now I see. I mean, everything makes sense.
Yeah.
But the danger of taking off the lens is that you become a dissident, and then you get in trouble.
Drawing the distinction between Talmudism and Judaism, biblical Judaism, and from a Christian's perspective, is of course the key moment is the persecution, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. They rejected the Messiah because they didn't want to forfeit their ethnic pride or their carnal desires. They thought they were special, and so then they set up Jesus's crucifixion and death. And then of course they had the rebellion 7 AD, the temple's destroyed, and all you have is Talmudism in their tradition, and that this becomes they start to worship themselves. And you have the Talmudic Judaism, which is completely, at least it becomes, they worship the rituals and just it's a compendium or a collection of rabbinical debates and discussions about how to screw people over and justify it and how to maintain group cohesion through that behavior. This is why we have a problem today. This is why you have the chutzpah, you know.
It's funny. I read Paul Johnson's History of the Jews many years ago, and he just discusses how what's his name? Ram, the Jewish philosopher, Moses.
Moses Hess?
No.
The humanist.
Rambam is how he's known.
Okay.
But I can't think of his actual name. He's a Jewish philosopher, and he has passages that are very, very anti-Gentile, like viciously so. But Johnson doesn't discuss that. He doesn't discuss any of the uglier aspects of all this this really, really, really tight tribalism of the Jews. And he'll make it seem as if, well, you know, they had to be that way because that's how they survived in Europe. But then you can take the other argument and say, well, maybe Europeans wouldn't have made it so hard on them if they hadn't been that way, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's, you got to look at both sides. And the Jewish apologists, the believers of the lugubrious school of Jewish history, just ignore the Gentile perspective, and they want us to throw our ancestors under the bus.
That goes back to that. It goes back to association's idea is, we'll admit what we did wrong. You have to admit what you did wrong. And they're not willing to do that.
Yeah, in many ways, the same way that blacks have this presumption of equality, Jews have a presumption of innocence.
Yeah,
and they observe the world with that presumption of innocence. And when you do that, you're liable to commit atrocities.
And by the way,
this is what I appreciate when Amy Wax recently said that Jews have a lot. I don't know when she said it, but I read somewhere that she said that Jews have a lot to answer for.
Yeah,
and there are honest Jews out there that know. That, we really did a lot of bad
things. Well, there's a difference between the Jews and Jews, right?
Fair enough.
You have to acknowledge the collective, the people, the organizations that represent those people for good or ill, and individuals who do have a capacity for introspection, self-critique, and can act morally. But the problem is, the political problem today is the major Jewish organizations are all Talmudic, and they're all, they have no interest in goodwill. They want to, their ideology is Jewish supremacy. And you said that is Jewish innocence. Well, under the dispensation of the modern world, if you're innocent, you're superior. So they believe in Jewish supremacy. The blacks are proxies of the Jews, organizationally, the blacks in the West. And they too embrace the solipsism and narcissism of their Jewish benefactors.
Yeah, they that's true.
And they can't self-critique. They can't acknowledge their own shortcomings or weaknesses. And you said presumption of equality without even acknowledging their own collective shortcomings.
Oh, my God. Yeah, they have a lot of those. The interesting thing also is that Solzhenitsyn is very scrupulous about basing his 200 years together on Jewish sources as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So the men that he brings up a lot are Joseph Beuckerman, Isaac Levin, and Daniel Pasmanek. Yes. And these were fellows that after the Russian Civil War, or after the Russian revolutions in 1917, wrote a book called Russia and the Jews, and basically hung a lot of responsibility on Jewish people. They basically said the same things that Solzhenitsyn says. And Solzhenitsyn really, really hypes these guys up, which is fine. But at the same time, he doesn't recognize that. Well, he does recognize it, but he doesn't give up hope how this might change. But he recognizes how they are their aberrations among the Jewish population and how they were called anti-Semitic themselves. And he brings up other authors, too, from the 50s and 60s and 70s who were very honest about Jewish culpability, and they were just trashed by their own people. Or they could be like Arthur Koestler and say that if you're not living in Israel, you're not a Jew. That kind of thing, where it's just like Jews who live outside of Israel.
That goes back to Spinoza. That goes back to Spinoza, who was a Jewish humanist.
I have not read Spinoza in decades, so I can't comment on him.
The rabbis burned his works, because he wanted to transcend it. That's the, everyone quit Spinoza as a good Jew. Well, yeah, but the rabbis hated him. And so,
didn't he want to take like Aristotelian, or an Aristotelian perspective and apply it to the Talmud or something?
He was trying to reconcile the Jew with the Christian West and the Enlightenment, so he's considered a human, but they hated him for it. Just like the German Jews in the early part of the 20th century didn't like the Ost Jews, the Eastern Jews coming in from the Perilous Settlement, because they were a very small portion of German society, but they were very integrated. But it was the Eastern Jews that came over, and this had a profound effect on the West, because it was the Ost Jews, the Perilous Settlement Jews, that came to the United States, and a cohort of them became very influential, like Jacob Schiff and these characters. They then turned around and they brought with them all their hatred, all their ancestral hatred of Russia, all their prejudices, and they were in a position to do something about it, because the U.S. government being so subjected to, because it's liberal, it was very easily hijacked, and it became increasingly hijacked throughout the 20th century by these people. To this day, now we have a State Department which is entirely Jewish, which, surprise, surprise, we're on the precipice of war with Russia. Gee.
Right.
Because they can't be diplomats.
The Jewish philosopher I was talking about was Maimonides.
Oh, yes. There we go. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's who I was talking about. Yeah. But, you're 100% right about that. Yeah. And the thing, though, that I think...
Oh, by the way, quoting Jews, you say he quotes Jews. There is what we say, if you quote a Jew for what he says, you're often accused of being anti-Semitic for quoting him.
Right. I mean, they have a kind of double standard, that not a kind, a definite double standard, that they think they're part of an aristocracy. And that's the thing, you know, I do believe that one way you can look at the history of the West in the last 150 years is the Jews were basically dispossessing the original aristocracy of the West.
Yes.
And they're now, they've replaced us. And a lot of the people on the dissident right are displaced members of the displaced aristocracy. We know that porn is bad for you. We know that materialism is bad for you, or too much materialism. We know that this and that is bad for you, but no one's listening to us because the people who are in charge encourage bad behavior among whites, among the people who are not the aristocracy and never were. And so we're on the outside looking in saying, you're screwing up our society. You're screwing up our population. And they're doing it with the complicity of the hoi polloi, because the hoi polloi doesn't know any better.
No.
You know?
Yeah. Well, they used
and so
to
they'll
be
get high on meth, or they'll overeat, or they'll, you know, join a church that's paused or whatever. And that is, and we know that's wrong. And we know that a good autocratic control, I don't want to have to be, it doesn't have to be autocratic, but a control, a natural aristocratic control, by the people who are of the same genetic stock as the people being ruled, you're going to have a much more benevolent and functional society.
Yeah.
But we don't have that because we have a foreign elite and a hostile elite that's in charge of things.
Yeah. And there's, you can chart this progression. You can chart this quiet revolution that occurred point by point, events that occurred, the sort of the Jewish ascendancy and the decline of the WASP elite. A lot of the WASPs were more concerned about Catholic ascendancy in the world, Jewish ascendancy was perhaps a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, the Catholics and the Protestants had more in common.
Yes. And there wasn't quite as hostile. There's some problems. As a Catholic, I'm very, critical of the WASP.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, you know, but those folks were only a few generations removed from the warfare in Europe, where Germans and English and French would just kill each other. And so, you know, they, I mean, you could argue about how Jews might have been behind it. I don't know, but I do know that the differences were more than just cultural, and it took a while for the whites to realize that they had more in common with each other, even if they're from different parts of Europe, vis-a-vis non-whites like Jews or blacks or whatever. It took them a while to figure that out, because back then, you know, if you're like, if William Taft is your president, and you're concerned about Catholics because Catholics speak to a higher authority than Washington, D.C. They speak to Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's a big concern, you know, because, you know, you have memory of Europe being at war all the time.
Yeah.
Or not all the time, but being at war. And so, you know, I tend to have a little bit of charity when I look back at whites who are confused about who the real enemy was.
Yeah, and it's again the what happened, you know, good in the West prior to the French Revolution, the Napoleonic period, when you had what remained of confessional states or integral societies, you had prohibitions or laws impeding Jewish power, meaning Jews had they could whisper into the ear of the prince or the king, they could be advisors, they could engage a certain amount of trades, but they weren't really full citizens. And the idea of the French Revolution was, you do away with these impediments, you become full citizens. Napoleon actually asked them that, can you be French citizens? They said yes, which turns out they cannot be.
That's why they remember Napoleon so fondly, despite the fact that he was responsible for millions of deaths in Europe.
And so the problem is, when you create the liberal society under the ideas of the French Revolution, i.e. the Enlightenment, these things, you create liberal societies that do away with these protections or these impediments to an alien group, which sees itself as a separate group. They admit to this, and therefore they cannot be fully trusted. They can't be given the keys to the kingdom, and they've been given the keys to the kingdom, or they've stolen
them. What's happening now.
And this is the function, you know, if you do things like usury, compounded interest, it creates an inexorable process where they're able to get a hold of the wealth, and they can leverage that wealth to pretty much buy up the patrimony of the country. And they're doing that now.
Yep.
You know, that's why David Rubenstein can buy up Monticello and turn it into anti-right, anti-white parade, you know, as opposed to a celebration of Thomas Jefferson. They buy up these monuments, or they impose DEI, or they, you know, you have the 1619 Project. Being all this is at the be- is being supported by Jewish patronage at one level or another.
It reminds me of the, remember Quisling in Norway?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. After he was executed, they turned his palatial residence into a Holocaust museum.
Yeah. Solipsism.
That kind of thing.
Everything.
That, I mean, that is a way to humiliate the defeated people. I mean, that, yes. That's a way to symbolize that you're in charge now. Despite the fact that you didn't build the society from the ground up, you came in as an invader in many ways. And that to me is just beyond offensive. You know, I'm going to have to wrap this up. I'm sorry. I'm enjoying the conversation, but I have
we're perfect timing. It's great. So I think we've covered it. I think we got through it all anyway. So it works out great. So,
yeah.
So anyway, the book, tell us about the book then. Where did you get it?
Well, I mean, it's available at Antelope Hill, and I'm pretty sure you can get it on Amazon and these other places. And it was very popular. People like it. I've had a lot of very good reviews. I've had a lot of good feedback about it. People have enjoyed it. It's 200 pages long. So it's not heavy or anything like that. Cause I know Solzhenitsyn, with his long, hard to pronounce name, is intimidating for a lot of folks who don't, who aren't aware of how important he is. And hopefully, you know, half the readership will use this as a springboard to read more of his stuff, and the other half will use it as a way to be informed about this great man and his work.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate
it. You're certainly welcome. That's Solzhenitsyn and the Right. It's at Antelope Hill. I'll provide the links. And thank you, Spencer.
Okay. Have a great day. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.